Welcome to the Telehealth and Medicine Today Unscripted Journal podcast series, where industry innovators transform healthcare. Today, our topic is building comfort and success at failing. Featured guest speakers are Sarah Harper, Operations Manager, AI and Biomedical Informatics, and Instructor of Healthcare Administration at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science. Samuel West, curator and founder of the Museum of Failure, and moderator, Dr. Paul Barrick, Chief Medical Officer, Prista Corporation. Let's listen in for principles on succeeding at failure.
Hello there. Welcome. I'm delighted to open up this panel on the science of failing. We'll talk about how failures are an essential part of learning in healthcare, and how they're often ignored or denied or often thought about as a bad thing. So today we have two distinguished guests. I will name them and then invite them to introduce themselves. Sarah Harper first, Sarah, would you like to introduce yourself briefly?
Sure. Thanks, Paul. I work at Mayo Clinic Health System. I'm the operations manager for the AI and biomedical informatics team. And I have about 8 years experience failing in healthcare, especially around technology implementation and learning from those failures. Prior to that, I was a school teacher and I'm a proud parent of two young children. So I get to practice failing every day and learning from those failures. So I'm excited to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Sarah. And then from Sweden, Samuel West. Sam?
Half American, half Icelandic, live in Sweden. I'm a psychologist by training. And then 5 years ago, I working on a PhD in innovation and organizational science and started the Museum of Failure. And since then, well, I didn't know anything about opening a museum. So I've made every single mistake that could possibly be made and made up some additional ones. So I'm an expert on failure.
Thank you, Sam. I like that. I think you should add that to your title, failure. But you know, what's remarkable about both of you have called out failure as an opportunity, and so many people and writers have talked a lot about the role of failure. So I'm going to ask different questions to both of you, and you can jump right in. Yuval Harari, the author of the book Homo Sapiens, argues that societies that don't individually team or society learn, they don't have mechanisms to extract lessons from raising their kids or raising their crops or raising their politicians, they're often destined to die out. So, and he argues that we need to be thinking about how learning is at the heart of everything we do. So, Sarah, do you want to take a first chop at that? So how is learning and failure sort of informed your work as well as your personal journey? And why is it something that's so hard to inculcate in organizations like hospitals or major institutions?
Well, to start with your second question first, why is it so hard to inculcate in healthcare? I think because the stakes are so high. You know, we all come to work each day thinking about the needs of the patient and ensuring that they have a good outcome. So if we fail, lives could be lost, right? People could be hurt. And so that's a really difficult conversation to bring forward and to admit. And so also, I think just from a societal perspective, we're raised very young to think that making mistakes is a bad thing. You know, we experience shame and embarrassment from a very young age, and we just sort of internalize that and bring that with us into our work environments. My kiddos actually go to a Montessori school. And what I really appreciate about their educational experience is they use things like glass cups. And they teach, you know, toddler age children how to sweep up glass. And, you know, if you break something, well, what are we going to do about it rather than, oh, no, you messed up and let me swoop in and fix it for you. Right. So I do think some interventions are needed at the base level of society to sort of embrace failure as an opportunity to learn a new skill and start to make new mistakes. Rather than repeat the same ones again and again. And I think in healthcare, particularly post-COVID era, we have to really double down on building in time for reflection, both individually and as teams, because we don't have that natural sort of commingling opportunity where we can gather, let's say, by the water cooler or the coffee machine and talk through a problem. We're really living and working in silos more than ever before. And that really combats or fights against creating a learning healthcare system. So we need to schedule time for reflection, both as individuals and teams, and create safe spaces to tell those stories of failure.
So I love that you've ended with that. So Amy Edmondson, an old friend, talks a lot about psychological safety. And she defines that as the ability to speak up without fear, without repercussions. And, you know, in the context of design, Sam, you've spent, it seems like, all your career thinking about this. This idea that, you know, each of these devices that you collect and collate speaks not just to the device, but it speaks to the organizations that design these devices. So why was it so hard for them to think about this and identify this when it was obvious that these things were going to be failures? So what kept them from learning that before they manufactured this and pushed it out and then and ended up in your museum?
Yeah, I mean, psychological safety is a huge it's a favorite concept of mine. And I mean, without psychological safety in a team or in a group, I don't think it's possible to learn from failure, because you need to feel safe to share your imperfections, your stupidity, your bad decisions, your silly questions. You have to feel safe within a group to share that information. And the only way we can learn from it is if we're willing to talk about those failures. So one of the issues that many, if not most organizations, it doesn't matter if they're cool, you know, Silicon Valley companies or tired institution, government institutions, the approach, I mean, we're all people at the end of the day, and we all sort of behave in very similar ways. When we feel safe and an environment does have what Amy Edmondson calls psychological safety, then we're up for like, this and it didn't work out, and then getting input from other people and other perspectives. The alternative is to feel threatened, and then all you do is deny, deflect, lie. You know, we have ex-presidents who are really good at that. Just like, you know, putting up a barrier, denying what you've done that might be seen as a failure.
So, you know, and that's a really important point. And Harari doesn't go to this point, but this idea that Ray Dalio talks about, radical candor, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, do we help our kids or our healthcare providers or our industrial engineers? Do they get honest feedback so that not every child gets a medal, not everybody is awarded for bad performance? So how do we create these elements where people, you know, you give a talk, for example, I give lots of talks and people say, good job. And I get really annoyed, not with them, but inside. I say, that's the best you can say after 1 hour. Good job. Can you give
me something for a week for this talk? You know?
So how do we help people give more honest feedback in a world that seems to be getting less and less comfortable and actually talking about how you can improve your performance? God forbid I might hurt you or insult you. I'm not talking about being rude. I'm talking about being constructive. So, so talk about that, Sarah, particularly in the healthcare, Sarah, on AI, a lot of things fall short. And are we able to help our engineers and clinicians get honest feedback without feeling that we've hurt them or we somehow stepped on their sensitive, some people call it snowflakey energies, but how do we best frame that so that we can reduce the number of prototypical cycles, we can get quicker to something that's actually not just an MVP, but something that actually can move us forward? So what are some of the lessons you've seen at Mayo?
Well, I've worked on a lot of different teams, and I'd say the ones that have a really healthy culture, really safe culture, that end up being learning teams within the organization are those that practice, you know, certain like agile methodologies, that they hold retrospectives, and they're facilitated in a way that allows for space for questioning and not judgment. So really, you know, the facilitator of the retrospective can ask open-ended questions, and it takes practice. You know, you're not going to hold a perfect retrospective the first time you do it. You need to do it again and again and again until people realize, oh yeah, this is actually what my leader my team lead wants. They want me to talk about what we learned from this past 2-week sprint, right? What were our highs and our lows, and what can we carry forward? I think another learning that I have as an emerging leader, I've really dedicated a lot of my recent professional development to learning about leadership, is recognizing that we can only control ourselves, right? Our how we model this practice to the organization. So I think we need to be vulnerable as leaders and start modeling, talking about our own failures, finding opportunities to tell stories where we didn't do excellent or perfect work, and sort of normalizing that in a team setting, and even asking for feedback on a regular basis, you know, helping our teams practice giving their superiors feedback is an obligation that we carry as leaders. I learned from a colleague in the informatics field a wonderful trick that he does with all of his direct reports. He asks at the end of every one-on-one, what's one thing that I can do that I can start, stop, or keep doing to better support you as a leader? And that individual at first is really uncomfortable. Maybe it takes them a whole year before they actually come up with some, you know, golden feedback for that leader, but it gives them practice as showing their vulnerability as a leader, their willingness to learn and get better. And it gives that direct report practice on speaking up when something isn't working.
Yeah, it can be dangerous speaking truth to power, right? So we have a culture of killing whistleblowers sometimes. And so either organizationally or some would say conspiratorially otherwise, but either way, the issue of being able to speak up without the fear of being punished, right? So this is a very difficult issue. And, you know,
I want to add in here with what Sarah talked about, leadership and role modeling behavior. I mean, psychological safety isn't a set of instructions, do like this and everything will be fine. That's one of the problems with it when trying to implement cultural change. It's a fuzzy concept. And most powerful way that it can be implemented in an organization is if the leaders are the first to lean into it. So if the leader is not willing to be vulnerable, is not willing to say, hey, I screwed up on that, you know, last week.
And both of you have talked about systems that are what we would call social technical systems. And I've been a student of Swedish systems for about 1,000 years. And one of the things I love about Swedish systems, aside from watching cartoons on Christmas morning, is the fact that an institution called FICA. And so I want to, Sam, talk about FICA as a way to make leaders more accessible, vulnerable, and as a forcing function, particularly in this days of Zoom, how we can use it as a way to build trust and social capital.
I wasn't expecting when I mentally prepared for this chat, I wasn't expecting to talk about FICA, but I'm happy to do that. FICA is the Swedish. It's not. It's more than a coffee. It's less than a meal. It's FICA is a time you take a break. You take a complete sort of momentary relaxation of organizational objectives and all that. You just take time to have coffee and something sweet with it. Could be whatever.
And it's a required. So that would mean every day, whatever you do for 10 minutes, you meet all your peers.
Yes. And you usually
no agenda,
it's
right?
it's usually in a different room as well. So you don't just eat your cinnamon roll and drink your coffee in front of your computer at your desk. That's not FICA. That's just eating something.
So it's a socialization of the team.
Totally.
Hide behind their technologies or schedules or secretary. They have to actually show up.
And you're expected, I mean, it's not expected. You do participate. And well, your boss might be your, you know, the power distance might be great in the workroom or in the office. When you're sitting there with the FICA, you're both drinking coffee, eating the same cinnamon roll, talking about the same issues. Whether the inflation is going nuts, isn't it? Yes, it is. Any of the issues that you address are usually then not work related. And of course, work kind of seeps in, but it's a very good way to flatten the organization because you're having a casual discussion with somebody who's way above you in the organizational hierarchy.
Yeah, and what I see it as a mechanism to build the vulnerability that Sarah spoke about. That is to say, you can write documents about these things, but when you create a forcing function and you rub shoulders with your bosses on a regular basis, that creates the openings for having these conversations. One of the challenges,
and your boss tells you when you're eating that cinnamon, when your mouth is full of that cinnamon roll, your boss tells you, or it doesn't have to be somebody out higher up on the hierarchy there, says that, like, oh yeah, they last weekend was horrible because they made some bad decisions when they're travel planning, and then it's okay, we're all in this right. this
it humanizes them. Life.
It does. Mm-hmm.
And mostly they use Chatham rules, so you can't quote stuff that happened during Pika. And so it's this mechanism for blowing off steam.
What happens in Fika stays in Fika.
Essentially. So I look at this as a social technical mechanism to help people realize that it doesn't matter how complex they are, at the end of the day, it's about the community, right? One of the things that we've seen quite a bit, and Ted Shannonfeld at Mayo, not there now, but did a huge amount of work around burnout, was that COVID has brought a huge amount of unhappiness amongst healthcare workers. A lot of discomfort, a lot of mental unwellness, a lot of turnovers, people leaving, people harming themselves. And the challenge, and this isn't unique to the U.S., it's in Europe as well, but it seems to be worse in the U.S. because it's very difficult to admit that I don't feel well. It's difficult to acknowledge without feeling that somehow something's wrong with me. And Sarah, one of my sons went to Montessori as well, and I'm struck by the Montessori as a model of learning, which is it's okay to fail. Because fail is not labeled in a negative way, but the connotation of it is that it's not about you're a bad person. It's about the circumstances in which you interacted. It's about the materials that you worked with. And so what are the lessons you can learn from that? So talk about, particularly in the context of a big medical healthcare system, how do you feel COVID has shaped the willingness of employees and staff to think about problems that happened before COVID? You know, many of these issues like staff burnout, turnover, are not new. They've been around for many, many years. People like to blame COVID for it, but in fact, COVID just exacerbated an undermined problem. So are we able to think differently because of COVID and use some of these different techniques you talked about, perhaps to regain trust with staff, perhaps to bring them closer, like a FICA-like model where they actually believe more fully, and where in many ways, Zoom and remote talking, learning meetings is actually undermining that willingness to speak up and be vulnerable.
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think in some organizations and in some teams, COVID actually brought people closer together. You know, there was a lot of solidarity that came out of that experience for certain teams, and a lot of creative innovation around how to support one another, how to find community, even amidst the isolation and the tragic death that was happening around us. Now, it's certainly, I don't want to minimize your comment, Paul, that this exacerbated a lot of the problems, like if Pandora's box was sort of creeping open, related to burnout, then the pandemic just burst it open, right? It just exploded it. And so I think as leaders of those systems, it's incumbent upon us to really double down on getting creative and finding ways to bring that connection back into the team, whether it's through FICA, if that's if you lead a sort of a team that co-locates or that can co-locate at least, let's say, monthly or quarterly, or if you lead a team that's always working together, boots on the ground, it's still really important to schedule time for a daily huddle and at least a weekly huddle that doesn't have to do with the nuts and bolts of the job, like Sam was talking about. And it's even more challenging if you lead a strictly remote team. But I think just being able to show that there's that intention there, that you're prioritizing that time for connection, is really powerful. And I would also challenge any leader that's listening to this to think about how can we engage team members, whether they're clinicians or administrators, in solving this problem. I think everybody recognizes we have a workforce shortage problem, right? But nobody's asking the people doing the work what their needs are. You know, and a lot of my work in healthcare technology design is engaging the end user in the product design. And that's a best practice, right, in the design world. But why don't we bring that into the leadership realm and say, hey, what would make this experience in your workday better, right? What solutions can we come up with together to help you look forward to coming to work each day, or at the very least, not dread it? Let's start there, right?
You know, what's very interesting about other industries is that they have this constant monitoring of threat and errors. It's part of their scanning opportunities for learning by learning from other companies and other industries, right? And when I looked at your museum online, Sam, and I'm very eager to visit one day, but when I looked at it, I thought, how much could healthcare learn from other industries? But for that matter, how much, say, could the US learn from Sweden and vice versa? And I was struck by, when I was reading and preparing for today, I read about the banking crisis in Sweden 20 years ago, which more or less predicted the worldwide banking crisis 15 years later. So when I looked at the various phones that you open up so delightfully online, how is it that these companies keep on having the same typology of failures? So why aren't they learning from each other? Why does every hospital have to learn the same way, have the same wrong side surgery? Why can't we learn from others? What keeps us as humans, as teams, as hospitals, as countries from learning from others?
So if we look at, there's two industries that are sort of exceptions. They actually do learn from their mistakes. It's the nuclear power and sector and aviation. So when something goes wrong, at least up until recently, it was such an aviation. Now they're also the bad guys. But the idea is something goes wrong and that information is then spread. There's something wrong, that this procedure or this technology doesn't work, there's safety issues, and that information was spread across the industry, regardless of what companies were involved. The same goes for the nuclear power industry. That's kind of where it ends. The rest of the industries are not as good at this. So if an organization, healthcare, is not willing to talk about their own failures internally in the team that is directly working with these issues, or internally in the organization, they're definitely not going to share it outside of the organization. So being willing to talk about it internally is the first step to be able to share that externally.
So I'm so glad you spoke about two industries that I spend a lot of time thinking about. And there's a great book in nuclear power called Hanging by Each Other. And it's a book about what happened after Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, where all the stakeholders came together and said, if we don't work together, they're all going to shut us down.
Exactly.
And so there was this collective spirit of collaboration. This is not what we do in healthcare. We like to talk a lot about sharing and learning. But in fact, what we teach a lot of our peers and students and trainees is that keep your mouth shut and keep your head down. And either formal or informal, you can't learn that way, right? So unless there's that radical transparency, unless there's the willingness to share that way, during the pandemic, I helped the chief medical officer at my health system, Thomas Jefferson. And at the time, and it's very common in many, many systems, most staff in the hospital have no idea how many patients we harm. If you ask a typical nurse at Mayo, I would imagine, Sarah, or my system, how many people fell last year at Mayo? And they'd go, I have no idea. And then you'd say, how many people had infections in your unit last week? And said, well, you know, I remember one, but I don't know. They don't share that data with me. Mm-hmm. And so what we did during the pandemic is that we first shared how many staff were sick with COVID in real time. And it was like the second week of the pandemic, and there was a lot of fear would leak to the public or the media. It never did. Mm-hmm. And it went so well that in the year three of the pandemic, or if you will, 3 years after, we started sharing all the adverse event data with all the staff. Mm-hmm. So every staff member, if they want, nearly in real time, can see how many falls, how many infections, how many that. And they're like, really? You're sharing this? Aren't you afraid this is going to fill in the blank? Mm-hmm. We're trying to change this environment where we're trusting them to see where the problems are so they can help us both identify the solutions, but also when we come down with ideas for improvement, they understand why, as opposed to the system is trying to impede us more. They're trying to create more restrictions, more rules, more paperwork, which the system does. Mm-hmm. What the system fails to do is help understand why we've done to this incredibly hard rule. So how do we, again, think about that? How do we engage our staff into the messy busyness of mm-hmm. leading health systems so they feel partially accountable for the process, not just the result, in a way that aligns with their personal needs?
This is such a powerful question, Paul. I think, so at least at Mayo, that data, there is a lot of data transparency, but I think there is a different issue that's impeding that information getting to staff. Is it the business model? It's not unique to Mayo. It's unique to our system of healthcare in the United States is working against us. It's that, and by and large, volume over value still, and sort of churning patients in and out the door. And if I have a free moment, I'm going to get an add-on. I want to ramp up my RVUs, and I don't have time and space to sit there and go and consume a dashboard, right, about those adverse events, unless it's intentionally scheduled and protected by my leadership because they see the value that that can bring to the overall organization. And sorry for the crude conclusion, but to the bottom line, right? So I do think returning to that FICA point that Sam was making, just having, you need scheduled time for human connection, but you also need scheduled time for intentional reflection about the work. And it needs to be protected at all costs. And so that dashboard can be available and it can be the focus point of your daily huddle. How are we doing on this quarter's objectives and key results, right? And have the team identify which one they want to work on and have them come up with the solutions. But just, I think time is our most valuable and precious resource in any aspect of life, but it's severely limited in healthcare. And we have some of the smartest, most compassionate people working for our organizations, and we're squeezing every last drop of juice that we can from them. And unfortunately, that's really the root cause of why we can't keep them on our staff.
Mm. If we thought about redesigning healthcare systems, right? Mm. Like all systems, it's a system. Another thing that we tend to ignore and not really teach our peers and colleagues. But if you had to succeed at failing, Sam, you've obviously had deep thoughts about this. Well, if you were in charge, you were the chief tech officer for a company, and you had to lay down the principles for successfully failing, what would be your top several things that you would lay out? What would be those foundational principles or succeeding at failing?
I don't have like a favorite 10-step plan, but two points that I would definitely include, and based on on the discussion so far. One is, as mentioned earlier, taking the time to learn from failure, taking time, learning, reading best practices and watching some guru on stage say this is the best way to do something. That's easy. And it's seldom particularly successful. To learn from mistakes and failure, it takes time, and that's what we just heard. It's lacking.
But time costs money.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, the problem is if it's going to be done at rocket speed, you're not going to learn from mistakes. Silicon Valley does not learn from mistakes anymore. In fact, they're worse at it than any other than the non. Fast moving.
Well, let's get personal about Sweden too. So the Karolinska.
Get to that. I think I know where you're heading, and I'm prepared. Yeah. One point I also reminded of this point by the Montessori talk of you mentioned that your daughter learned to sweep up glass mm-hmm. when she broke the glass, right? Mm-hmm. So one of my things when I'm out missioning on my mission of failure in the corporate world is that the corporate world is really good and healthcare maybe in particular, at sort of failure avoidance, like sort of preventing failure, preventing things from happening. And there's so much resources put in that, whereas there's not much being done about failure recovery. And what Montessori teaches is, no, sometimes you break a glass and then you sweep it up and then you smile, right? Whereas the healthcare sector would be spending millions on not breaking that glass at the cost of everything, rather than prioritizing recovering from that failure. Before somebody says, yeah, but people will die and they suffer. Not everything in healthcare is about saving lives. Like, right. 99% is not about operating on people.
Right.
And then the second point is experimentation. We think it's great in science. We think it's great as the scientific method. But then all of a sudden, when it's in the corporate world, we say, oh, experimentation. Oh, I don't think that's for us. How can you innovate and how can you adjust to a fast-paced, you know, changing environment if you don't continually experiment? Those are my two points.
Paul, may I add just a quick comment there? Yes. I feel like it's on this podcast, especially speaking to this audience, we need to talk about the importance of documenting our failures, right? Both internally and externally to the scientific world. We need to tell stories of failure. And just by reflecting on our failed experiment and writing it up and publishing it in a journal, we're sharing those lessons with the scientific community. And I do think at certain organizations, protecting the brand is prioritized over contributing to science. And that is very dangerous. That's a very, very dangerous practice, right? Because then we're opening up everyone else to make those same mistakes. And especially in a field like healthcare, where people can become harmed, or where we are losing our workforce, or where our margins are so tight, we have an imperative and a duty to tell these stories of, we tried this and it didn't work, and here's why, and this is what we know now. And you should know it too.
So, you know, I know it's broad afield, but I'd love us to think about, there's a big phenomenon around the world of celebrities taking pictures without any makeup. Imagine for a moment that we as organizations would be willing to show our brand in not the ideal angles, not the gorgeous, you know, photoshopping abilities, you know, architects. I was going to go to the Karolinska New Hospital, but I'll stay away from it. But it's a colossal example of remarkable local wisdom being contaminated by ideas, and then showing these gorgeous pictures of buildings. And this building is, I think it's 14 billion euros, and it's going to mortgage the entire Swedish country for 1,000 years, maybe. But the point I want to ask is, are we ready? Can we? Are our brands strong enough? I mean, Mayo perhaps is the most recognized healthcare brand. Can you imagine Mayo showing up without makeup, metaphorically, and allowing people to see how hard it is and difficult it is to actually build up that brand and show all the work that gets done, including the missteps, all the takes that didn't work, so that people can see how hard it is? And I don't know if you've read Len Barry's book, but perhaps the best book on Mayo. He spent 8 months at Mayo 10 years ago. He's a marketing professor at Texas A&M. And when you talk to Mayo people, they say, if you really want to understand the spirit of Mayo, you have to read Len's book. So Len talks about what happens behind the brand. And they gave him access to everything. And it's a rare glimpse into how hard it is to be an exceptional brand like Mayo. So is Mayo ready for that, Sarah?
Oh man, that's a tough question, Paul. I think I'm gonna punt that one to Gianrico when you have him on the podcast next. But I would say it's a courageous decision, right? I think heavy is the head that wears the crown, right? And Mayo's vision is to be a category of one, right? It's not enough to just be number one. We need to be in a category of our own. And that's a heavy burden to carry around, right? And we are all brand ambassadors, proud brand ambassadors for the organization. I do think it takes a really courageous set of leaders to make the decision to take that calculated risk and say, okay, we're going to take our makeup off here in this environment, in this setting, and share some of our failures, right? I think it could be really powerful, really transformational for the industry. But I can't speak on behalf of the organization, you know, and with regards to our plans in that arena.
I mean, I ask about that because so when you go to Stockholm next, as Sam knows, there's a massive ship called the Vasa. And the Vasa is a remarkable example of what happens when leaders are so arrogant that they're unwilling to listen to their advisors, right? And so when I talk about leadership, Sam, I talk about the Vasa as a fantastic example in which the best of technology, the most cutting edge AI equivalent at the time, sinks in front of 10,000 people in the harbor and then is gone for hundreds of years. And all this wisdom and arrogance is all entombed in the Stockholm harbor. And then, of course, the brilliant Swedes decide to build a museum around it in the harbor, so that you can't escape it. Every time you go, you see a monumental example of what happens when our leaders don't listen to the nurses and physicians and engineers and saying, it's not going to work. And leader says, no, I'm going to announce it. It's going to work. By hook or by crook, you're going to make it work. So what are the equivalent lessons for healthcare, Sam?
I'm holding up. You mentioned you mentioned Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. Probably one of the more prestigious sort of medical institutes or hospitals in Northern Europe, at least.
And one of the only organizations that has a tight relationship with Mayo, where you can work in both places with similar documentation. But
I didn't know that. That was interesting. You mentioned the buildings and this sort of scandal around how much the business solutions finance the buildings were rotten and will cost the Swedish state a lot of money for the next 1,000 years. I thought you were going to mention this one. This is the trachea from Macchiarini. It was a superstar surgeon at Karolinska 2010-2011 that 3D printed the trachea. I'm holding a copy of that right here. It was probably the biggest sort of medical research fraud scandal in Sweden. Karolinska got carried away at this new prospect of 3D printing organs and coating them with stem cells from the patient. This superstar surgeon claimed that his surgeries were perfect and everything went well, when in fact the patients suffered and died. And he received huge amounts of funding, both from Sweden and the European Union. Given the rock star status and the frenzy to be the best in the world and the most, you know, at the forefront of innovation, Karolinska, with all their reputation and all their experience and knowledge, they decided to let the rock star do his own thing rather than subject him to the regular controls and balances. And as you mentioned earlier, they didn't listen. Leadership didn't listen to Macchiarini's, the surgeon's colleagues, who continuously told leadership, something is rotten. This is research fraud. There's something wrong here. They weren't shot as you do with whistleblowers in the States, but they were silenced, it led to the death and suffering of a lot of people. Now he's in prison, but that scandal shaked the confidence in Swedish clinical research for at least a decade or two.
Well, you know, what's also very interesting about that case is, we used to say, so I spent several years in the military as a physician, that in order to break the rules, you first have to know the rules. You can't have innovation without the framework. Only after you master the rules are you invited to break the rules if they need to, but you have to justify why, right? So that means that physicians and nurses and others involved in innovation in AI or hardware or software, it doesn't really matter. In order for them to not, you know, use the fake it till you make it model, which is the model out of Silicon Valley, you first have to learn how science works. Then you can decide to break it at the margins and bend it, right? So you first have to understand the role of honestly reporting about that. And only then are you invited to break the rules, as opposed to break as much as possible, right? Which seems to be the take-home message for some, that is a way of innovation. Obviously, in healthcare, the danger of that to the patients, But what about the staff around that who see this corrupted world? How do they feel? You know, we call this the second victim. How do the nurses and doctors around this Italian surgeon feel? We've had our own examples in the US. So talk about some of the staff when they see organizational branding failures, when they see things around COVID or around these things. How does the staff feel, and how does that play into their moral injury, as it's being called these days? Sarah first, and then please.
Wow. Yeah, that is so powerful. I would say, if you believe in the mission and the core values of the organization, you take it very personally and very deeply. It's a painful loss or injury. And many folks will revert to protecting the organization and distancing that individual from it, which I think is a really healthy practice from many vantage points. But then the missed opportunity there is to not stop and ask ourselves, well, why did that happen? What role did we play as team members, as leaders, or as members of this organization in enabling that individual to get away with that crime, right? Or to go against our core values. So I do think it's a two-step process, and we frequently miss the second one, which is the most important, especially vis-a-vis this topic. I do want to mention The Power of Regret. It's a book by Dan Pink. I think it's his most recent book. He came to Mayo just 2 years ago to give a talk about the power of regret. And essentially, when folks say, oh, I have no regrets, you know, I had a great career, great life. He feels sorry for them, because that means they don't practice reflecting on their mistakes and learning from them. And so if there's one thing that we can all do, it's creating a failure resume. This was an idea from his book. Is sit down, when you write your resume, you're thinking about, what are all the awesome things about me and all the reasons why I should get this job, all the cool projects I've worked on, and what were the outcomes? But can you do that same exercise? Can you practice real vulnerability with yourself and write down every failure that you've had? And then in the next column, what did you learn from it? So I love that practice. I think it's a very powerful exercise for individuals, but also for teams, which really rolls up to the organizational level of learning from failure.
And as a way to learn from failure risks, right? So appreciating that. So one of the things, and Sam, I'm curious your thought about this, particularly as it relates to making the language, the taxonomy, the terms of risk and risk management more and better understood to frontline workers, who often, I don't think, really understand what it means to be at the margin of the risk curve, and how easy it is to cause an extraordinarily brand failure. So an organization that has 10,000 employees is as strong or as weak as any one employee that might lead them to incredible loss of reputation or finance, or even worse, even shutdown, as we've seen in other industries.
Yeah, I think one thing I thought about was, I mean, if the organization itself is more insists on presenting itself only with a full makeup on, so to speak, then of course that doesn't give the employees, the staff, any freedom to also sort of bring their full self to work, because they always have to be fully clad in full makeup as well. So in some ways, like if there's an authenticity within an organization, like, this is who we are, and sometimes we mess up and we try to reflect on it and learn from it, then I'm absolutely convinced that does create the right type of atmosphere. I worked with a big global manufacturer, very successful, who proudly showed me in the basement of their headquarters. It wasn't medical or pharmaceutical, but we went down in the basement in their fantastic headquarters, and they had their own museum of failure. So they had all the things that they had produced, both product-wise, service-wise, and even sort of management practices and sort of trends and fads that they'd gone on misadventures with. It was fascinating. But then the sad thing was, they said, it's locked and nobody's allowed in here.
Beautiful. So we, there's so much more to talk about this. And it's a topic that, animates a lot of how I think about how we can help healthcare. And so I want to just, bring us to a close with some final remarks from both of you. You know, telehealth and telemedicine, this remarkable journal, and publisher who's bold and courageous, but are there risks that could happen to a young organization if it, you know, encourages this type of thinking? So as you think about closing remarks, we've talked about all the positive things. What are the risks for organizations for identifying failures, particularly when they don't have enough reputational cushion, and how best to mitigate them so we can still encourage this idea of failure and report on it and celebrate it, but also be cognizant of the trade-off potentially and the unintended consequences? Sarah?
Wow, that's a great question too. I think we have to balance it with sort of focusing on our strengths too. It's not just okay, we failed. What did we learn from it? It's really like, what did we learn from this experience, right? Whether it was a success or a failure, there's some gem to be mined from each one, right? So if you can build in that habitual practice of reflection, whether it's as an individual or as a team or as an organization, to say, okay, these are our major milestones. What did we learn along the way? Then you can internalize those learnings and make it about growth, right? Make it about growing forward, rather than just focusing on all those negative aspects. And kind of, as a leader that I admire used to say, admiring the problem, right? You start to spin and spiral. Set up that habitual practice of reflection, and you can name it as a failure, or you could just name it as labeled as an experience, and not be afraid to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, but have it be time limited, right? The objective is we can clearly articulate what we learned from this and what we're going to do next, and then you move on.
That sounds smart. I'm just like, yay, I like that. I mean, yeah, you don't have to prolong the suffering. Like, hey, let's just figure out what happened. Let's learn what decide on what we should avoid or what we can do next.
So it sounds like you're both saying that we need more courageous leaders, organizations, and brands to be bolder because they know about these deep-seated problems. And so how do we inspire that courage to lead in that way?
I mean, my main thought when you tried to say, when you asked about the risks of sort of not embracing failure, but accepting failure and being too sort of accepting of mistakes and failure in an organization, I don't actually think that's a risk at all, because by its very nature, an organization is control, 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 efficiency, meeting objectives. That's the machine, right? You would have to be very powerful to disrupt that machine. And any talk of vulnerability, authenticity, admitting and learning from mistakes, taking the time to do so, it's a trickle. I mean, there's no risk of that taking over.
Yeah, Paul, to answer your question too, I think it starts with one person, right? It starts with each individual recognizing that it's impossible to learn that which we think we already know, right? That's an Epictetus quote. Like, you have to start with your own daily practice of humility and self-acceptance. And I keep saying it over and over again, but I have learned from some wonderful mentors and coaches the power of reflection. Whether it's for 5 minutes a day or 30 minutes a week, just being able to examine yourself is a courageous act. And if you can start to build that into your daily or weekly practice, you are going to be a better leader for your organization or for your team or for your family or whatever you lead in life.
You're saying right there is the exact opposite of Zuckerberg. Move fast and break things, right? Well, look at Facebook or Meta.
That sounds like a toddler.
Exactly. It sounds like a toddler.
So if there's one source, a book or a reference, a website, a movie, a play, a poem, one thing, Samuel, that you recommend for our listeners that would summarize a part, an element that you would like them to go deeper on as they think about this topic, what would it be?
I have a bunch of things that are serious, but I just thought of one now that's not as serious as it is beautiful. You have to spend some time Googling this because I can't remember the name. There's a racehorse in Japan. There's a little short film on YouTube about this racehorse in Japan a few years ago who kept losing every single race. And what happened was they were going to close down the race course because racehorses were out of fashion. Young people weren't interested. It was losing money. And then somebody at the racetrack said, hey, let's make this loser horse. Let's give it some attention. So they gave it some attention and it transformed the whole organization to become the most popular racetrack in all of Japan, all because people were rooting for the real horse, the one who tried hard but never really won. I don't know exactly how this relates to our discussion and conclusion, but it's a beautiful story of like, we're tired of the shiny, happy, successful rich people. We hate them. They're boring. We want real people, real, like the real stuff. The loser horse is one of those.
I like that.
Sarah, nurse is one of those.
Your recommendation?
Well, my podcast co-host, Elliot Wilson's going to kill me for not plugging ours, but I'm going to plug somebody else's podcast.
Yeah, do that.
Yeah. Ryan Holiday has a podcast called The Daily Stoic, which I highly, highly recommend. And it's usually about 3 to 7 minute episodes, very digestible and very much draws upon the learnings, the self-learnings of Marcus Aurelius. And I think a lot very applicable to what we've been talking about here today, that if your organization is going to start learning from their failures, you have to start learning from your own individually first.
I love that. And I'll end with one of my favorites. So Edgar Schein, who was a giant who died many years ago, has a series of books. My favorite one is called Humble Inquiry, which is how to ask questions that reflect your humility and not your arrogance as a leader, as a peer, as a parent. And so asking better questions as the secret for learning from failure, as well as avoiding, you know, the depression, the judgment, the sense of guilt and shame. Hard to do in an industry that aspires to perfection and excellence, and therefore being without makeup is really hard at all times. Sarah, Sam, thank you for this remarkable conversation and podcast. And I appreciate the candor, the stories, and really hope we can continue this in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Sam. I had fun.
We appreciate your tuning into THMT's Unscripted podcast series. Want to learn more or have a comment about the program? Have a novel evidence-based approach or solution to share with our audience? If so, send an email to info@partnersindigitalhealth.com or visit Telehealth and Medicine Today Journal. Thanks for listening to Unscripted from THMT Journal today. See you again next time.